We are now on episode two of You Got This, our resilience series. So if you recall, I'll just read the definition that I've been using. Resilience can be viewed as a defense mechanism which enables people to thrive in the face of adversity, or more commonly stated, the ability to bounce back, often stronger than before, in the face of adversity. But I like this one because we're thriving even during the adversity. And if you recall, we came to the conclusion that there are some trainable characteristics or skills that resilient people share. And that these skills are really more telling than your history or the experience that you're having or have had, which is actually pretty good to know. We are not at the mercy of our past, or we don't have to be. And the trainable characteristics I broke up into three categories, being positivity, self-determined action and lifestyle, and connection with others. And we're going to be spending some weeks. Yes? The third one? Connection with others. Which is quite a challenge in these times. We're going to talk about that more specifically next week. So what I want to look at today is how mindfulness relates to this and why, what's the process and all of that stuff. And I want to refer to a neuroscientist called Rick Hansen. Okay, I know some of you have heard of him. He's also a teacher of mindfulness. And one of the things that he's studied and teaches about is the shift from a state to a trait. So a state is when we do a loving kindness or a feel good technique and we get ourselves all calm and feeling happy and it just feels wonderful. And that's a state that we have brought ourselves into. But then the meditation finishes and we get up and we go do something and then we get all uptight again. Or a state might be a deep state of concentration and peace, but then we finish and where does that go? A state, when we turn the state into a trait, that means that the state has become part of our character. It's just naturally there. And you've heard me talk in the past about raising your baseline level of certain things, with concentration, clarity, equanimity, or your baseline level of positivity. That is sort of the same thing, is turning a state into a trait that's just always there, that you don't have to specifically go and get yourself into. Now, it's relatively easy to achieve a state. It may not always feel like that when we sit down and meditate, but and you all have ways, if you're feeling down, ways of cheering yourself up, or if you're stressed, ways of calming yourself down. And you've got ways of doing that, right? You take a nap, or you watch a good movie, or you eat something you like, or you have a gin and tonic or something. So we all have ways of getting into the states we're looking for. And in meditation, of course, we can be directly aiming for that state in meditative ways and learn to get into them. But converting that to a trait is actually I'm going to say it is more difficult, but it's appallingly low. It's not impossible, But even amongst meditators, the conversion rate, not because it's so difficult, but because people don't know what they need to do to make that conversion, is really low. And you know this because there's so many meditators out there who always need to stop and go meditate so that they can get back into their state, right? We want to make that conversion so that we can just be there. We're either already positive, or it doesn't take much to bring up that positivity or to bring up that calm. And yet, it doesn't seem to happen very much. The way that conversion is made, it's actually a physiological thing, right? So it's not just creating a new habit. It's not just willpower. What happens, for example, one of the things that happens is, say you get into a state of calm, it triggers certain parts of your brain, certain parts of your brain light up, saying, oh, this is calm, this is nice. When those bits of your brain light up, you get an increased blood flow into that part of the brain. Over time, that increased blood flow actually builds tissue, just the same way as doing reps does. So your brain in that area actually gets physically bigger. And so there's like more of this calm section of your brain actually exists. So, and of course, there's lots of other things going on. I'm no neurologist. But the point being that the conversion is not just training yourself to quickly become something. It's actually changing your brain so that you've got a bigger muscle there. You've got more tissue in those areas that light up when you're in those states. Does that make sense? I actually find it, in addition to finding it really fascinating, I find it really encouraging. That it's not just a matter of willpower, because then the days that I'm really not feeling like I can do what I need to do and I don't have the willpower, my brain has still grown. And so that has become a trait. And that's what we want to work on with resilience is converting states of certain characteristics, flexibility, ability to see adversity as a challenge, not as a victimization thing, certain things like that we talked about a bit last week, and we'll talk in the future. But we want to get those things to become traits so that they're there for us when we need them. So how does this state to trait conversion happen? Well, according to what's his name? Rick Hansen, there are three things that have to happen. And he says there's this saying that neurologists like to say amongst themselves, that neurons that fire together wire together. And I actually remember hearing this a long time ago when I first started in therapy. My therapist telling me that they used to think that your brain, once it was mature and developed, stayed as it was. But recently, and this was 15 years ago, so recently in terms of neuroscience, they're learning that your brain changes and that you can create new paths. You have ruts from your past of ways you've done things. You can retrain your brain to have different paths. And you do that by firing the neurons together that you want to connect. So in other words, you want to create a state, and you want the neurons that are related to that state to be firing, and eventually they will connect into a more permanent trait. That is my very vague, hazy scientific description. But what it means in practical terms is that there are three things that you have to do. One is that you have to train this state on a regular basis. It doesn't mean that you have to do it for hours at a time. Dr. Hansen says you do a repetition for the duration of at least one breath. So that is not a long time. We can do that. But you do it a couple times a day, or three or four times a day, or frequently, depending on when you remember to do it. But you do it over and over and over, even if it's just for a very short period of time. And it being whatever it is you're trying to convert, this state of calm, or this state of confidence, or this state of happiness, or whatever. So you have to repeat it for the duration of at least one breath. Yes, Sean.
That was it. Do duration of that. The duration of, so you do the duration of one breath. Sorry, I missed that. Okay, thank you.
Right. That's a minimum. You obviously can do
Right.
longer.
Thanks. Sorry.
The second thing is that you need to feel it in your body. Right. And, I loved hearing him talk about this because it is exactly what I've been teaching about feeling in your body the physical sensations of whatever the state is. So, say you're doing a classic loving kindness meditation, right? And you're saying, "May you be healthy, may you be happy, may you be blah." You just start saying this in your mind over and over and over, but you're not feeling anything in your body. That's just a mental exercise. And yeah, that's good because it trains you to think positively. But in order to change it into a trait, you need to feel the emotion that you're working on. And we will talk about the nurture positivity techniques. We've done them before, but that is a classic example of a way that you can work on an emotion. You can trigger an emotion and feel the emotion in your body for the duration of at least one breath. And then the third thing you have to do is to focus on what's rewarding about it. And this relates to the negativity bias that we've talked about. It's part of our evolution. It kept us alive as a species to focus more on the dangers and the fears and what we don't know and all of the negative stuff than to focus on the positive. But the positive is a reward state, and we want our brains to recognize that this feels good, right? So we in the example of nurture positive, we bring up the emotion we want to work with. We feel it in our bodies, and then we notice the that it feels good. And we focus on the pleasantness, the positivity, the rewarding aspect. It might not always be positive emotion. It might be rewarding in that it feels good to push through challenge, or, depending on what you're working on, is going to have different things about it that are rewarding. But that's what you want to focus on is the physical sensations and the rewarding aspect of that. And those three things are going to trigger those neurons to fire together and eventually to wire together so that that state of positive emotion or that state of endurance or whatever it is becomes a permanent characteristic of our brain. So that's sort of what we're going to be doing. One of the many things we're going to be doing is those three parts of the process to convert states into traits or to learn the skills of resilience. So How do you do that? Well, there's lots of different ways. If you were to go online and look up resilience training, there's, loads of ways that you can teach yourself. Mindfulness is the one we're all here to do. That's the one that I know about. It's not the only way to learn these resilience skills, or even broader, to learn the skill of learning skills so that you can learn, you can do it yourself in future when you find that you want to work on an aspect maybe that we don't cover in this. But mindfulness is one really good way to develop skills. And just to remind you what definition of mindfulness I work with is the three learnable skills. Does that sound familiar? Three skills of concentration, clarity, and equanimity that we can train ourselves to use when we pay attention to something. So paying attention to something with concentration, clarity, and equanimity is mindful attention. Meditation uses those skills to pay attention to what we choose to pay attention to. And we can, that's what I would call a mindfulness technique, is applying the skills. And so we can use mindfulness techniques to train the traits. That came out sounding a lot more convoluted than it did when I was thinking about it earlier. But the point being that mindfulness is a great way to learn resilience skills. And the system I teach, Unified Mindfulness, is particularly good at that because it's sort of designed to be teachable, it's modular, it's flexible, it's you can apply it very specifically to the specific things that you want to learn. So I don't need to go into the system because you all know it. But it's just ideally suited to learning resilient skills. So what I would like to do tonight in terms of meditation is not do specifically resilience tonight. I want to review with you the core technique of unified mindfulness, which is the see, hear, feel technique. And the reason is that if you get see, hear, feel, then you've got all of the elements that we can use in the future to adapt or amend or mix and match as we apply these techniques to specific things that we're working on. So see, hear, feel is like the core technique with all the basic elements of this way of doing mindfulness. And then next week we're going to actually start looking at resilient skills and working on some things to help us with the holidays. We've got some specific challenges this year. As Deb, you mentioned, being alone during the holidays, especially when we say connection is one of the important skills for resilience, that sort of thing. We're going to be doing that next week. But I want to make sure that we've got this core technique down so that we can jump right into that without having to spend a lot of time learning the technique. So does that sound good to y'all? Any comments or questions before we get into see, hear, feel? Excellent. Okay, do you all, I mean, you've heard me talk about this many a time. Do you feel like you sort of know what see, hear, feel is? Or do you want to review from the beginning? Excellent. Yes, good. Do you want me
Because
to
I can't
review?
remember it, so I have my cheat sheet.
That's great. That's really good. So how much do you want me to go over the basics? Or do you just want a quick review?
Just go up a little if you don't mind.
Okay, so I'll do this and then just wave at me if there's anything you want me to go into more detail of. See, hear, feel is a noting technique. And you recall what noting is? It involves noticing, soaking in for a few seconds, releasing your attention, and then noticing something again. Either the same thing or something different. Labeling is optional. If you want to use it, you use it at the moment that you notice something. And labeling is just putting a very, like, 5% of your attention goes into making a label of which category what you're noticing falls into. And it helps just keep you on track. It's sort of a quality control. If you notice that you're not labeling anymore, you know that you've lost the track. So the categories are going to be see, hear, and feel. I should say the categories of what. What being any aspect of your experience. So if you divide experience into visual, auditory, and somatic, you can cover the whole range of anything that comes to your attention, especially if we put smell and taste into the physical aspect. So far, so good? Okay, so see. Sean, tell me about see.
There's see out, which is physical sights. And there's see in, which is mental images, like things I might, a tree if I'm seeing it in my head. I do have a question about this, since I almost, unless I'm doing walking meditation, almost always have my eyes closed. There's very little see out that happens. Right. So should I be meditating more often with my eyes open?
Only if you want to note see out. Did you say that you do this while you're doing walking meditation?
Yeah.
With your eyes closed?
No. That's the point was, see, I was very unclear about that. The point was that I do see out mostly. No. The point was the only time I actually get to do much see out is when I do walking meditation.
Right.
And I open my eyes for that usually.
Well, it's totally fine to open your eyes when you're sitting.
Okay.
And you can do both. You know, you can start one way and open them and close them. And I actually tend to follow what, if I'm tired, actually this is not true. If I'm tired, my eyes want to close, so I try and keep them open. But if I'm quite awake, it's hard to keep my eyes closed, so I just let them be open. So you can do whatever works. You can choose to have them open or closed. You can just let them do what they want to do. Totally up to you.
Okay, thank you.
So that's good. That's see. And Sean has made the distinction of in and out. So internal experience that our brains create versus external experience that we perceive. Hearing, similarly, external sound versus internal auditory thinking. There's always a few gray areas, like the buzzing in your ears. Is that hear out or hear in? We don't want to get too caught up in getting things right. What you want to know is that you are able to detect, know what you're detecting. So if to you the buzzing sounds external, you can call it hear out. If it seems more internal, you can call it hear in. So long as you know that what you're hearing is the buzzing in your ears. And also that will change. And the point being, don't get too hung up on the labels. And then feel out is physical sensations, which might be inside the body. If you feel your heart beating or indigestion, it's physiological objective sensations. Feel in is emotional type body sensations. you know, that tension when you're upset or the smile when you're happy. Now, when we're doing see, hear, feel as a technique, we don't actually distinguish between in and out. You will quite likely know if it's in or out, but you don't have to remember how to label that. We're just going to stick with see, hear, or feel, if it's visual, auditory, or somatic. So that makes sense, right? Okay. Now, if you were all newbies, I would now do a tour of the senses. And we would go through and I'd say, okay, imagine a tree, that's see in, and listen to my voice, that's hear out. Do you want me to do that? Do you feel like you don't need that? Okay. Oh, good. Then we can probably just go ahead and get started. I'll talk you through it, just, you know, with the basic instructions. But I'll ask if there are any questions first. Excellent. So the reason this is a core technique is because it involves all three modalities, the see, hear, and feel. Everything we do is going to work with one or more of those. We might be looking at different characteristics. You know, later on we might be getting to flow or rest or whatever, but it's still going to be in see, hear, or feel. And this involves the noting technique. So that's why this is sort of the core, because it involves everything and the terminology and the experiences that we're going to be working with in future.